on record here. So so who's here? Check in.
Hayward. Hayward here.
Michael?
Tracy, Arthur?
Bridget?
Who is Karen? Was that Karen? Who came after Bridget?
Yeah.
Okay.
George is here.
Okay, Cecilia, George. Anyone else? Okay. Well, it's a pretty... Oh, Sudaba. That's Sudaba. Okay, well, let's get going. Now, last week, I suggested that people might like to come up with a question and post it, and nobody did. So I'm going to pass over that in silence. But I'm going to make a similar suggestion this week, and I encourage you to take it to heart. I'd actually like to see people posting something, especially people who have not been active on the website. I mean, it's late in the course, and it's not as though we're going to create a new habit pattern, but I'd still like to see people check in. Anyway, that's just by way of prologue. What I want to kind of emphasize in this week's discussion and see how you feel about it is the way in which, although we are talking about time, the material in this chapter begins to move toward knowledge as well, and knowledge becomes a really important theme. And of course, that makes sense because we are talking about a unified vision, and you could say that time and space are gateways to knowledge. You could say it differently too, but in any event, time and knowledge are certainly connected, and so is space. And there is a little bit of a mention, a little bit of a referring back to space in this chapter too, which I also want to discuss when we get there, or at a certain point anyway. But if we start by looking at this, at the theme of knowledge, it shows up in the first paragraph. The chapter starts, the paragraph starts by talking about past-centered ways of being and losing, you know, freezing the dynamic of time. And then it says, so why? Why does this happen? And that's the question we've been starting to look at in the last couple of weeks. What's going on in our experience that keeps us from really activating the aliveness and thus the freedom of time? And the paragraph says, well, one way to investigate this question is to look at the fundamental not knowing characteristic of our experience. And then it says, you know, the first thing we don't know about is time. And then it analyzes that. But the basic idea here, I think, is if we knew our experience better, if we understood, what's a good way to say that? If we were more tuned in to what was happening in our lives, tuned in, you could say, to the aliveness of our being alive, then that knowledge would automatically connect us with the freedom that time offers. But we're not. And Rinpoche doesn't exactly discuss that. He just says we can start off by being aware of our not knowing. But what I want to suggest is that there's a way in which we could investigate that, which comes up whenever we become aware that something is missing. That's just one way of saying it. There's many, many different ways you could say this. But I think it's, you know, looking at my own experience, I think it's a fairly important way of analyzing or investigating what goes on in our daily lives. Because so often, you know, sometimes things are going really well, we're really involved, and there's not any sense of anything missing. You know, we feel fulfilled, we feel alive, we feel engaged. But other times, there's a kind of an uneasy feeling, a kind of a disquiet, or a sense that we're not happy. That's one way to put it. A sense that something is missing. And if you want to investigate not knowing, I think those moments of something missing are really good ones. Or, you know, there are some related questions that seem to come up. One is to ask, what's holding me back, or what's separating me from my experience? Or what am I not noticing, or what am I taking for granted? Those are all ways of asking this question, which Rinpoche suggests we ask, of looking at the not knowing that operates in our experience. So in Buddhist terms, I think you might say, we need to know why we're not happy. But in terms of TSK, I think the question is more, we need to know what's missing in our experience of time and space, and what's the knowledge that's missing as well. So when Rinpoche starts to talk about that, well, let me stop and see, is there any comment on that? I'm presenting that, you know, not because it's some great insight, but because the question comes up again and again, how do we actually practice? What do we do, you know, from day to day and moment to moment? And a lot of the time, as people have been pointing out in their posts, a lot of the time we just forget. We don't do anything. We're just caught up. We're caught up in the story, the narrative, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But sometimes we notice that something is missing, so that's already a very important point, is to be aware of it. And then the question is, what do we do? And that's really what I'm suggesting. Okay. So the main focus in this chapter is the witness, in terms of what Rinpoche really describes, and this structure of the witness. One way to look at that is not, Rinpoche just barely touches on it, but for those of you who've been taking this sequence of courses, one way to look at it is in terms of space. When we talked about space, we talked about the story. And here we're talking about the narrative that the witness tells. We construct a coherent narrative, it says at the bottom of page 102, and of course the self is at the center of that narrative. So when we're talking about space, we at least in a couple of the TSK books, Rinpoche says something very similar about how we really inhabit a story. And what I want to suggest is that there is something very similar, very parallel, between the ways in which we investigate space within the story, within the world, you could say. Let's use that term for now to make it clear that it's a little different from the narrative. So within the world that we inhabit, there is this allowing quality of space. And within the narrative that we construct, there is the dynamic aliveness of time. But we don't know how to access those. So with regard to space, what the TSK vision seems to suggest is that we really want to tune in to the allowing in the sense of the feeling of the world that we inhabit. You know, here we are, we're in the middle of our situation, and there's a sense of asking what's going on. So you could say the aliveness of our experience, or you could say, there's a nice phrase in Dynamics, in the space section, I think it's in Dynamics, the feel of the field. What's the feel of the field? Or you could say, what's the aliveness of the temporal order? The point in both cases is that we don't do that. We get sucked up in identity. and in particular, of course, the identity of the self. And the way that gets talked about here is in terms of the witness taking a stand. And the analysis here, which I think is really clear, is that taking a stand, and of course there's a little play on words here, because in a courtroom, when you call a witness, in American courtrooms, the witness takes the stand. That's the term that's used. So here the witness takes a stand. And by taking a stand, you deny the flow of time. But at the same time, you lose track of the openness of space. And that's really the point I'm making here. And there is one place in the chapter where Rinpoche mentions that. It's on page 110 in the second full paragraph. He doesn't use the word space, but he says, the witness presupposes the structures of ownership and identity as central to reality. Dismissing the freedom of the zeroless, it makes the substance of the recorded the unvoiced theme of all its testimony. And that phrase, the freedom of the zeroless, is a kind of a oblique reference, I guess, to the freedom, the openness of space. So, you know, this whole metaphor of the witness and the trial and judicial proceedings is, I don't want to make too much of it. I guess I'm interested in it because my training is as a lawyer. But it's interesting to think about for just a moment. There's a passage in Love of Knowledge where Rinpoche talks about the self feeling uneasy in the world. And he says, the self is like an illegal alien living in a country, always afraid that it's going to be caught and its papers will be revoked and it will be deported to God knows where. you could imagine, if you want to extend that metaphor, and I'm taking it further than what Rinpoche does, that the self has been caught and hauled into court, taken into court, and asked to defend itself. And so the self calls the witness to the stand and says, well, look, this is the way things are. I'm legitimate. Here are my papers. Here's my identity. And that is a kind of a nice working image for what happens. But in order to do that, you have to give up the possibility of being something more than what you identify yourself as being, and of living in a world which is more alive and more open than the world that you identify. So, it's sad. when you look at page 103, I'm looking at the second full paragraph, Rinpoche says, if you're trying to establish an identity, then time becomes kind of overwhelming because it's always washing away the identity. You know, it's like there's a famous image in Buddhist texts about trying to write on the water. It's kind of like that. You try to create an identity, and in the next moment it's gone because the stream, the river has moved on. So it's a little bit panicky almost. So the witness creates this identity, it creates this here, and as it says in this paragraph, there's a clarity that comes into that. You say, well, this is the way things are. And it's useful. Either in this chapter or the next, Rinpoche says, you know, we don't want to do away with the witness because it does perform this useful function. But what happens is that clarity is purchased at the price of richness and aliveness. It's single-minded, as he says here. And we make use of it. We order and we measure and we judge and we pronounce and we assign and we trace. I'm just reading all the verbs that are in that paragraph. And as a result, we come away saying, well, we know something. Something has been established. And that's our answer to the problem of not knowing that we started with. But it's an answer that has its limitations. And so that's why, to come back to what I said in the beginning, it's very useful if we get into the habit, whenever we notice that something is not right, whenever something feels limited or constricted or frustrating, or our energy is not good, or there's a kind of a sadness or weariness, to ask what's going on, because those are occasions when we may be able to go behind the mask, behind the identity. So Michael's post, for instance, this last week, when he talked about hitting bottom, you know, we find ourselves in a situation, and at a certain point, everything collapses, and it's, you know, we just have to give up. And giving up has a potential, anyway, if it's a very thorough giving up, let's say, of also being an opening up. But one way or another, we have that opportunity to question. And the times when we're most caught up in our usual way of being can be some of the most fruitful in that sense. Not always. In fact, probably mostly not. But there is always that potential. Okay, well, I've been talking, so I'm going to stop for a minute and see if anybody has anything to say about that.
Maybe I do?
Yes.
Michael? You know, both in what you're saying now and in your post, Jack, you raised the issue of our time and space kind of equal doorways and the way we cover them over. There's some similarity. I was really interested that in the previous section we had all these elements of the self presented, the narrator and the objective self, and then the witness was just left for later. And I was always curious about how would we bring up the witness later.
Okay.
And it's interesting in this chapter we brought it up more in the context of time.
Yeah.
And it seems a much more difficult obscuration is there. Like, with, you know, like if the narrator tells the story, you always could consider it to be whimsical or like not the final word, you know, and it wouldn't sort of annihilate your sense of identity to do that. But the way the witness seems to operate by being so dramatically threatened by the dynamic of time that it's got to obscure all that. And even in what Rinpoche says in the chapter, it doesn't seem like there's a real easy way of bypassing that, that the witness will kind of almost always be with us somehow. So I found that kind of like, in terms of your question about are the equal doorways, it seems it's harder for us as human beings to contact the dynamic of time than it is maybe to intuit the presence of space.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, in the introduction or the preface to Love of Knowledge, there's a section where Rinpoche says some people are just naturally, they find it easier to work with space, and some people naturally find it easier to work with time or knowledge. And then he gives some suggestions for how to break out of that single approach and be able to work with all three of the different elements. So it may be that you're describing something that's more true for you than for, you know, there may be others who find it easier to work with time. That said, if you look at, I have to point to Buddhist texts, there's an awful lot that's written, at least in the Tibetan tradition, about space and sky-like awareness and things like that. And it does seem to be a way that we're constantly being invited to go beyond our limitations. There's not as much that's written about time, although that may just be my own limited knowledge. There's a whole branch of teachings, for instance, that I know nothing about, the Kalachakra teachings, which and Kalachakra means the wheel of time. sort of the teachings on the Wheel of Time. So
there. The notion of impermanence as inherent in its movement in time.
Okay, very good point. That's very true. So it's not as though it's not brought up in the Buddhist context at all. And impermanence, not even, you know, there's a lot of different ways to work with impermanence, but one way would certainly be to activate or to let your awareness of impermanence lead you to the dynamic aliveness of experience. It's not usually presented that way, in at least in the fundamental Buddhist text. It's usually impermanence is presented more in terms of not holding on to things because they're going to pass. But that's certainly related. So yeah, okay, I think that's interesting and helpful. And Michael, since you bring it up, I was going to suggest that in the discussion that you were referring to is in Love of Knowledge, and we did it in the last course in the winter. We worked with the chapter that does that. And it would be interesting to go back and look at that chapter again. I was thinking of it especially in terms of the discussion of single-minded knowing, because that's what Rinpoche talks about here. We were just looking at that. And in the chapter on Love of Knowledge, he uses the same phrase. Here he says single-minded clarity, and there he says single-minded knowing. But that's the chapter in which he introduces all these different aspects of the self, and the last one is the self as witness. It's true, he kind of postpones discussion of that. Now, if you look in the index to Love of Knowledge or do a search if you have the CD, you will see that the theme of the witness comes up in various places. But here it's really central. And it's really solid, as you say, Michael, and there is a certain sense that we're left with in this chapter that it's one of the hardest things, that when we talk about the witness, we're right down there at the core of what we insist on. What we insist on is having a certain kind of clarity and a certain kind of stability, even at the cost of losing our freedom, or you could say losing the qualities of joy and openness and even love, even at the cost of all of that, we have to have something to hold on to. And the reason we do is because it's wrong. I'm resisting saying it's a lie, but you know, we build everything on the basis of this foundation. And so yes, when we start talking about the witness, it's really hard to penetrate that, just because we're at the stickiest, densest part. So this chapter gives us some suggestions, and we'll go on now to a little bit of, you know, to go into that a little more. The next chapter goes more in that direction, and the one after that, which is where we will end up, you know, there really is the beginning of an approach, a way of working with this. But that doesn't mean, you know, when we read those, we'll figure it all out and go home. It's challenging. Okay, so Rinpoche does talk, as he moves further in this chapter, about the difficulty of doing this. And I'm looking now at page 104, where he says we have a problem if we try to expand the range of our knowing but are still holding on to the witness. I thought it was worth talking about this paragraph for a moment, because there's a kind of a critique of a certain kind of meditation or meditation tradition in here. I don't think it's a critique of every possible kind of meditation, but there's a way in which we can misunderstand what's going on in meditation. So the last chapter on page 104, he says, let's just skip their first sentence. He says, there may be ways to expand our present awareness in time. For example, by cultivating intuition or vision, deepening concentration, or developing a meditative stillness. So, you know, those are all wonderful things. and they sound very inviting. But then he says, a little later, further on, he says, still, we will ultimately come up against the boundary established by our present presence. In other words, the witness takes a stand, and then we have a present moment in time. And that's where the witness is located. And that's a boundary. And we won't be ways of getting beyond it. And it means that our knowledge is going to be limited in the same way. So you can have all sorts of very fine experiences in meditation, but you need to be able to go to a deeper level in some sense. As he says on page 105 at the end of the next paragraph, he says, whatever our efforts, present awareness cannot measure temporal fullness. So some of you may have heard me say this before, but Rinpoche has said, he's written somewhere, that there's this phrase that's left over from the 70s, was popular back then, where we say, you have to learn to be here now. And that was kind of a slogan, be here now. And Rinpoche says the problem with that is that people don't understand be, they don't understand here, and they don't understand now. And that's what we're talking about here, is our failure to understand the limitations that are imposed by our sense of be and here and now. And they're all tied into the witness. And they, in the context of this chapter, we can say they're all tied in with our accepting a temporal structure on which the witness relies. So, at the bottom of page 105, or actually the first paragraph after the heading there, Rinpoche says, we have the possibility of questioning that, right? Why should we accept the structure that restricts knowledge to the present? Which is actually kind of a remarkable question. I mean, I think it's taken for granted that, of course, we can only know the present in some fundamental way. But he says, why should we accept that? And then he says, once this question has become real, the claims of the witness prove difficult to comprehend. So this is a nice challenge or invitation. Because he said the question is, how does that question become real? You know, we tend to take it for granted that the only thing that's real, and now I'm using the word in two different ways, but the only thing that's really available to us, let's say, is the present. And he's saying we can question that, and he says we have to make the question real. So, how do you do that? How do you go about doing that? Well, he gives a couple of suggestions, and it's, I think a good way into that, and maybe that's about all we'll have time for today, is to look at the second paragraph on page 106. He's saying that the witness makes a certain claim and it turns out not to be true. So the more the witness strives after knowledge of what happens in time, the more it becomes enmeshed in an isolated subjectivity. In its own self-interpretation, the witness confirms this split. In other words, here I am and I'm the one who knows. And in terms of knowledge, that's a really fundamental thing that Rinpoche points to, is this claim that I am the one who knows. And there's a sentence, I think, from Love of Knowledge, that has always been very meaningful to me, where Rinpoche says, knowledge is not what the knower knows. But that's our claim. In this picture of the world that we inhabit, that we ordinarily operate with, there's a location for knowledge, and it's the knower. I'm the one that knows. So the witness tries to affirm its own subjectivity. And so I'm going back to the text. It is the originator of knowledge, somehow carving the known out of the great undifferentiated mass of not knowing that unfolds from moment to moment throughout the range of linear time. And then Rinpoche writes, yet in fact the opposite seems more nearly true. Cut off from time's dynamic, the witness moves within a vast sphere of not knowing that its acts of naming and authenticating can never penetrate. So one way to think about that, so it's a very sharp contrast that's being drawn here. And one way to think about it is that the witness is given by time. That's a little bit, there's a way you can talk about TSK that sometimes becomes like jargon, but in this case, I think it's helpful to say the witness is given by time along with everything else. And if the witness claims to be the one who knows what's given by time, it leaves out of account its own being given by time. And so you wind up with this not knowing that we've been talking about throughout the conversation today. And you can point that out, as he says at the bottom of 106. You can show that logically there's a real problem there, but that doesn't necessarily help you, because logic just fits into the same structure. So if you want to really challenge the witness, or you want to make that question real, the question that we were looking at on the previous page about, how does he put it, the question why knowledge should be limited to the present. If you want to do that, you have to see what the witness is doing in the present. I want to suggest a couple of ways of doing that. One we've already worked with, and that is looking at the past, present, future structure of each moment. That was an exercise. It's an exercise taken from the first TSK book, and we worked with it a few weeks ago. Didn't talk about it too much, I don't think. It's important, it's helpful, because it's a way of challenging the focus on the present. Now, ordinarily, we think, the present, that's where we want to be. But if you begin to see that every present moment, in the usual sense of present moment, has a past and a future that go with it, then something deeper opens up. So that's one way to approach it. Another way to approach it that is more in terms of our ordinary experience and is kind of related to what I said earlier is part of what's going on with the witness, and now let's just say the self. The self is not exactly the same as the witness, but now let's just say the self. Part of what's going on with the self in this moment right now is that I have certain needs and wants and fears and anxieties and, emotions and all of those different things that we've talked about. So maybe right at this moment I'm thinking what I'm going to do after this phone call, and that's that's conditioning what's going on right now. So one way to investigate or challenge whether knowledge is limited to the present is to challenge that feeling. You know, not the content, but the sense that accompanies it. It's like, I'm worried about what's going to happen next, or I'm looking forward to what's going to happen next. And that's a kind of deeper level of the content of the present moment. And if we challenge it in the sense of just not accepting it as the whole truth, not like saying it's not true, we do in fact feel that. But if we say that's just also something that is given by a deeper temporal structure, then that gives us a way into this, a way to investigate. So those are a couple of possibilities, and you know, I would suggest that you see if you can come up with your own way of doing that. And then I want to make one more suggestion that I will put in the little essay too, and that's a formal exercise. It's exercise 20 in dynamics. It's on pages 324 and 25. And it basically turns us toward, or invites us to look at sense experience. So, sense experience is a really central way in which we say, well, what's real is what's going on in the moment, because I can only sense in the present. And this exercise, although the exercise, the instructions for it are really pretty, what's the word? There's not a lot of instruction. Rinpoche really says, just do it. Don't worry about it. Just do it. But it's a way of asking us to look at sensing. And so that would be another way of questioning this commitment to the present in the kind of limited way that we have. Take a look at the very end of the chapter where Rinpoche talks about turning inward within the present immediate arising. I'm quoting from page 112, and maybe review what he says about how doing that, how turning inward within the immediate arising, which is kind of a clue to doing that exercise 20, by the way, how that's not subjective, and how if we see that, then we can say that time itself can become the conductor. That's page 113. So I'm kind of slipping and sliding through some stuff pretty quickly there at the end, but maybe review those sections and then go on. And we have another chapter here, not the whole chapter. It's pages 115 to 125. And the reason that I drew a dividing line there is because in those first 10 pages of the next chapter, we're continuing to explore our ordinary way of being, our ordinary way of knowing, and the claims of the witness. We're doing it in an interesting way because Rinpoche says, well, let's tell a story. You know, if that's what we like to do, let's establish a narrative. But instead of a narrative that puts the self at the center, let's tell a different story. So that's what he's doing in those first 10 pages. And then in the end of the chapter and into the next chapter, which will be our last week, he suggests and explores in considerable depth the way to go beyond that. But we need to be clear. We need to be really tuned in to what it is that we're doing, and especially in those moments when we have the sense that something's not going right. Those are the really fruitful places to look. Okay, I think that's it for today. Covered a lot of ground. It's such rich material. It's a pleasure to work with it. So do see if you can post something, anything, this week, for those of you who haven't been. And we'll talk again next week.